when you don't have a strategy, you are constantly in reaction mode. When you have a strategy, then you're able to respond appropriately. And the difference between responding and reacting is like night and day. Hey y'all, welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. I am your host, Kaylin Romaine, and I'm excited about this month's topic because it's going to be continuing our conversation on organizational development. But instead of speaking on the change management models that I talked about last month related to OD, I'm actually going to spend this month speaking on what changes when you enact change management. So in my book, Evolution to Equity, I speak on the four change shifts that take place in organizational development. And it's interesting because these changes can actually take place whether you're applying them in a professional setting or if you are applying them in your personal life. Of course, I'm going to be pulling in examples from real life. And I was thinking, like, do I want to take examples that are only from the work world? And I actually felt that I wanted to take on examples of TV shows and movies in, related to people's personal lives and then juxtapose that to how it shows up at work. So here we go. Today, I want to start out the month by introducing the four shifts, and then I'll spend each episode this month talking about each of the different ones. So we got four of them. And the four shifts are strategy, operations, employee capacity, and structure. So those are the four shifts that occur through organizational development and change management. Again, strategy, structure, employee capacity, and operations. Now, I got to look at my notes to give y'all the definition. So here we go. When you change strategy, that's a change in the reporting lines or the hierarchy in a group, system, team, or workplace. When you shift and change operations, that's a change in your core and or cross-functional workflows. So how things get done in the company or in the group, across teams, across functions. Third, you have employee capacity, which is a change or shift in core competencies, organizational survival skills, and labor distribution. And finally, when you change or shift the structure, that results in a change in the organization's goals, brand positioning, stakeholder focus, or verticals. So again, each week we're going to talk about a different change, and I want to start this month talking about a change in strategy. Strategy for me is always the core of anything that you do, because when you don't have a strategy, you are constantly in reaction mode. When you have a strategy and it is a fully baked strategy, then you're able to respond appropriately. And the difference between responding and reacting is like night and day. When you react, you are allowing other people to do what's called emotional hijacking, which means that they're in control and whatever their emotional state or whatever their strengths, weaknesses are, they are leading the way. And the goal for managing your own life, your own team, your own company is that you are the leader. If of nothing else, yourself. We've talked before about emotional intelligence, but I think it's a really good pin to put in the conversation here because emotional intelligence, of course, has five components. Traditionally, it's four, but there's a fifth one now related to motivation. But the first component is self-awareness. So are you aware of your own emotional state? Are you able to tap in and have a level of insight into how you're feeling in a given moment? I've talked recently with a client about an emotion wheel, and that's simply a circular graphic that lists out the core emotions. I believe there are eight. It's either five or eight, but I love certain versions because it gives the next levels of that emotion. So for example, sadness is a core emotion. Well, by sadness, you could mean disappointment. You could mean a sense of despair. right? There are levels to it. And being able to identify and especially name an emotion is a powerful tool for building strategy because you get to see and understand your current state. Strategy is useless without understanding where you are currently. And again, that goes for you personally as an individual, a team, no matter how large or small, and an organization, no matter how large or small. What is happening right now? And you almost need to know that before you decide where you're going to go, because sometimes our goals can actually be reactive too. Let's take what's happening right now in the economy, for example. So at the time I'm recording this, there is a new crazy news story coming out almost every day. And for a lot of people, they want to jump ship immediately. It's very reactive. I'm going to jump and do this. I'm going to jump to do that. And I'm not saying that people should not, because maybe that will be the best choice. But my concern is that if you don't really know where you're starting from, how will you know whether it's a smart choice to leave or to stay? Leaving or staying in an environment, a job, selling a particular product or service, doing a particular marketing, a ploy or marketing campaign, you have to understand what is that starting point. And so that, again, going back to emotional intelligence, that level of self-awareness is critical. And self is not just you as an individual. Again, it could be your team or your company. What is the starting point for y'all? After you figure out your starting point, and you can start that process of understanding by locating yourself on the emotion wheel, giving people a chance to vent, doing some brainstorming, then you want to go to self-management. So what does best practices look like for you in this phase of yourself? In order for you to make the best strategy, in order to make the next best move, what choices should you be making? How should you be positioning yourself? It's interesting because a lot of times we assume self-management is us taking action, but self-management can also be holding steady or falling back. And I've experienced this in my own life many times where I'm a doer. I've talked about this before. So as soon as a thought comes to my head, I'm like, okay, I need to activate on that. But that's not always the best choice. Sometimes I need to gather more information. Sometimes I don't have the right connections and relationships. Sometimes it's just not the right timing. So every idea that comes to you, every time you recognize, okay, a change needs to happen, it might not be the right time to change. The right time could be an hour from now, but it could be a month or even a year. It doesn't mean that you can't continue to prepare. It doesn't mean that you cannot set yourself up for success and continue assessing, continue gathering the needed resources. It just means that you may not be positioned to take action because it may not be possible for you to succeed in that. And strategy helps you figure out that information too. Last thing I want to point out with strategy is that strategy must be flexible. So really good strategies are as grounded as they are flexible. Strategies tell you, what are we aiming to get to? What are all the resources at our disposal? What's the timeline, all of that good stuff. But it also gives you a chance to change things up and be agile. And that agility is the key to actually achieving the outcomes that you want. Again, strategy, change, it could be individual, meaning one person, but it could also be a team. It could also be a whole company. And guess what? Those three entities are contextualized in a larger world. So I'm changing, every other individual around me is changing, every other team around me is changing, every other company around me is changing. And so just because I'm making changes and I have this plan, guess what? I might not have as much power or influence, or I might not be able to lead in this space. So if that's the case, sometimes you might end up being a little bit more at the mercy of other people. So if you don't have flexibility in your strategy, you are going to have a very, very difficult time. So interestingly enough, with the change shift of strategy, we're talking about reporting lines and hierarchies. And everyone has a hierarchy. Every company has a hierarchy. Every team has a hierarchy. There is a social hierarchy. There is a functional hierarchy. And it's interesting because for most people, they think, well, if my company is not hierarchical, it doesn't have a hierarchy, and that's not true. So some companies are more what was called in organization theory, organic, meaning you kind of work more in like pods. It isn't a hardcore reporting line. But like I said, even if it is not functionally hierarchical, socially, we are designed to look for leaders, the point person, the person in charge, the person to give us direction, even if we want to rebel against that person. So it's interesting about rebellion, because in order for you to rebel, you have to admit that someone else has power. You have to recognize power in order to be rebellious. Otherwise, what are you rebelling against? And when we think about, especially as women, when we consider how our careers shape up and we say we're pushing against the system, we have to admit that current systems, current structures, current workplace cultures are designed with someone other than us to be in power. And so in order for you to admit that, that's the beginning of you. Again, we talked about current state. That's the beginning of you ideating on a strategy to build change. So from the idea of hierarchy, what does hierarchy accomplish? Because I'm actually a person that appreciates hierarchy. I don't always want it, but I see the value of it. And I want to clarify, what's the value of hierarchy? Hierarchy serves to create clarity. So when it's done well, it creates role clarity, it creates system clarity, it builds in metric clarity, because you know who is making decisions, who should be taking actions, how will we measure the success of whatever those entities, people, technologies are doing. And that clarity gives us a sense of safety. This occurs in all social groups. So whether it's the friend group, you know who is the mama of the group, who is the wild child of the group. You know, funny story with that. So I had little pods of friends, and I used to try to get all my different little pods of friends together, and none of them liked each other, but they all liked me. And I'm talking about I had like four or five of these little friend pods, and they all serve different purposes. So I had one person I was friends with, and this person was just like staunchly stoic, rule-based. I don't do this, I don't do that. And so when I wanted to keep myself in check, I would go tell that friend stuff, because I knew they would be like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. That's crazy. Then I had my like wild child friend. And when I wanted to turn up, that was the friend that I went with, because they were always down for a good time. They didn't really care. They was just doing them. Like very free spirited. And then I had my deeply ambitious friends who, I mean, they were going for it. They had all the goals, everything lined up, and only doing this, straight focused on school, straight focused on this. And when I knew I needed to get my life together, because I had a short term goal to achieve, I spent more time with them. And then I had the friends that were deeply family oriented. And so when I wanted to be kind of babied a little bit, or I think I'm stick with baby, because that's the best way to put it. When I wanted to be babied a little bit, I'll go kick it with them. And so all of these different pods served a purpose. But even in that, even though those pods were not connected other than through me, I still created a hierarchy for it. And I had a strategy for how I navigated that hierarchy to get things done. And when I think back to the years between, I say like 12 and 21, each of those types of friends served a purpose and played an integral role in my ability to thrive. And even when I wasn't thriving, because sometimes I was struggling, but navigating all of what I was experiencing. Now, here's where I'm going to challenge you, sis. Because ideally, you learn the benefits of hierarchy in a family structure. So one of the first places that you understand social hierarchies is at home with your parents or primary caregivers. If you have nannies or babysitters, siblings also create social hierarchies. Whether that's the lack of siblings or the presence of siblings, if you have a lot of siblings, just one sibling, if y'all are the same gender, different genders, what's the age gap? All of that impacts how you see hierarchy. And then when we move outside of our nuclear family, our extended family provides a sense of hierarchy too. So I know for me, my aunts and uncles and my grandparents were just as much a part of my social hierarchy and how I understood the world as were my parents. And it's interesting because, and I talk about this a lot now to people, my brother was raised 100% in his childhood by our mother. So he always lived with our mother. But I spent what added up to like over half of my childhood between our mother and grandmother, maternal grandmother. So during really critical moments and for large blocks of time, I'm talking about years at a time, I would be with my grandma. So my value system, the way I navigate the world, how I talk to people, how I set goals, how I build confidence, how I navigate difficulty, all of that, to be honest, is informed by my grandma. And I can see stark differences between us now. Like I always kind of could, but now that we are adults, and especially since, unfortunately, all of those parental figures have passed on, I can see very clearly how the differences in how we were raised are showing up. And that's not a value judgment. It's just the truth. Like I can just see it. And I think it surprises other people sometimes because they know that me and this sibling, at least on its face, were raised together. My two other older siblings are way older than me. They were like grown when I was born. So people assume that we would be more similar in our mindsets than we are. But I know it is because I wasn't necessarily always raised with him. The interesting part with that is I believe so strongly, and it becomes more and more clear as I navigate the world, that God blessed me to be parented by my grandmother because he knew what I would need to do what I'm doing. So first of all, y'all probably wouldn't even be seeing me on this podcast, right? Because the types of lessons my grandmother instilled in me set me up to go on a path that has now led to me doing stuff like this. But if my mother had raised me 100%, even beyond the issues that she and I had, there is no way that I would be doing most of the things that I'm doing. There's no way that I would think the way that I do. I would probably not have the connections that I do because my grandmother's way of interacting with people had a strong influence on the way I interact with people and build relationships, both personally and professionally. And my mother was not like that. And so I think about that a lot now. I'm so grateful. I mean, as a kid, it hurt very much, but I'm very grateful now as an adult to have seen my grandmother's way of navigating the world modeled to me and getting a front row seat to seeing that. I was thinking about my grandmother recently because, again, with all this happening with the economy, I was thinking of how my grandma would do stuff. Now, fun facts about my grandmother. She was born right before the start of the Great Depression. Actually, no, I think it has just started. And she grew up in coal mining country in West Virginia. So I think it's called like Appalachian mindset, frugal, make the best of things, very resilient, hardworking, believe deeply in community, strong core of faith, well-respected, beloved. I mean, I can remember being a kid and like all of her nieces and nephews would call and talk to her. If they came into town, she would be like one of the first stops to come and see. And my grandma had like 5-6 siblings and there were several siblings in Detroit. So it wasn't like she was the only person, like her nieces and nephews just adored her. And, you know, just I can even remember my mother and her siblings' friends because they had the same phone number. I kid y'all not, for like 50 years. Like literally that house phone number was the same thing. I can still remember it in my head. But I can remember folks would call and come by that my aunts and my mother hadn't seen in years. And they'd be like, hey, you come by to see me? And they're like, no, I came to see your mom. Like, I just want to come and see Miss Nancy. So that was the type of effect that she had on people. You know, I remember people asking her, you know, Miss Nancy, can you just pray for me? And her ability to study the Bible and hear from God. My grandmother was a prophetess. And so it was just all of this stuff about her. She was just like the quintessential, now that I think back, like Renaissance woman. She cooked and she had this amazing green thumb and she was excellent at keeping home. She had amazing taste. I remember that she would always have her nails painted red. I remember being a kid, she was much fairer than me. So she was actually quite fair. And then she, her skin tone darkened over time. But why I'm bringing this up is her undertone was different than mine too. So she wore a different shade of red than I probably would wear. So sometimes she would let me sneak and put on her red. And I would always be like, I don't know if this quite looked right. But now I know, now that I know about undertones and makeup and all that stuff, I'm like, oh, it's because it was a different shade, right? And so again, you know, playing in my grandmother's rouge, and she didn't have her ears pierced, but she would have these like super flamboyant clip-on earrings with pearls and the gold swirls and things. And all of those types of, all of those aspects of womanhood, again, I got to see up close. I think I've talked about this before, but if I haven't, one of the reasons why I love scents, because I make my own body products. Like when I travel, I have a particular product that I travel with that I buy just because it's easier to transport. But at home, I make my own body products. The only thing I buy is facial skincare. Everything else I make from scratch myself. When I first started doing it years ago, everybody was like, well, how do you get into that? And I was like, honestly, it's an extension of my childhood. My grandmother used to mix up my lotions. You know, if you Black and you listen to this, you know, one of the worst things you could be as a Black person is ashy. Like, that's a no-no. So my grandmother, she would take such incredible care to bathe me. And I'm talking about up until I was like almost a teenager. And then it was like a spa day every day, y'all. It was literally like a Turkish bath. Now that I think about it, with that big old sheet, because she would use like hand towels to wash when they were really rough. So it was good exfoliation. I mean, it was insane. Like the amount of love my grandma poured into me. But anyway, she would mix up my lotions and she only wore Estee Lauder perfume. So she would take some type of oil. So it could be baby oil, mineral oil, something like that. She would take a couple sprays of the Estee Lauder perfume, usually of her choice. Occasionally she would let me pick, but usually she would pick for me. And then she would have like a mixer. We would call it like a carrier. So like a carrier oil, carrier lotion that wasn't really scented that much, but it had nice texture. And she would mix that up with another scented lotion. And she would bake these scent blends for me, y'all. And she would rub me down, make sure every little spot was gleaming and shining, Vaseline on the face. I mean, it was insane, making sure hair was oiled, all my breasts were in the right place. So just the level of precision that she put into me. She would iron my uniforms, because I had to wear a uniform to school. And one of her first like formal jobs was actually working in a laundry. She went to visit family and would work there. I think she did it a couple of years, but it was like summers or something, in New York at a laundry. So her ironing game was like through the roof. I remember going to school and teachers would ask like, did your family send your uniforms to the dry cleaners? I'm like, no, my grandma ironed my clothes. And so she would iron my stuff and it would be like standing up. I mean, she had this thing down pat. It was crazy, y'all. It was completely insane. But those are the memories that I had of how do you present yourself to the world, right? Are you intentional about how you smell, how you look, the colors that you wear, what side your hair is parted on, what type of shoes do you wear? I remember I got some penny loafers and she was like, you got to put your pennies in your loafers. You need to shine them up. And so she would shine my penny loafers and make sure that my socks fit a certain way. So sometimes I will wear the little knee socks with my uniform. And just, again, her intentionality in how she prepared meals and was it balanced and did it have all of this. She made some of the best scrambled eggs to this day that I've ever tasted. It was insane, but she was a cook. That's what she did for a living. And so everything was just so intentional. The plants that she kept around her home. I'm talking about, I grew up seeing like 50, 60 plants. It was insane. Green Thumb is an understatement. Having that level of femininity and that type of womanhood and intentionality, having that modeled to me at such a young age, I needed that desperately, because now I see that in how I do things, right? Like if I'm looking up, because I'm looking at my office, if I was to show y'all my office, you would see it's like I can see my grandmother's mindset in it through and through. I keep plants now. I taught myself, because at first I was struggling, y'all. I would be killing plants, like whatever the opposite of a green thumb is. That's what I used to have. But I taught myself how to engage with plants and keep in bouquets of flowers and things like that around my house. So I bring that up because when we talk about hierarchies and social hierarchies, everything that you have been through and that you have experienced has prepared you to build the strategy you need to thrive right now. So as much as I would see it as indulgences and my grandmother building a home and building community and building a family and building care and being known as the person that folks could come to be supported and be seen and heard largely without judgment, that is a strategy. And if I think about it, my grandmother was never without, like not in my lifetime. And it wasn't because she was ever rich. It was because she had cultivated and invested in loving others so much that it was like a no-brainer for people to show up for her too. And that is a strategy, right? If we think about a hierarchy, hierarchy is also how do we show up for others and prioritize others, ourselves, community, investment versus withdrawals versus deposits. Right. All of that is a hierarchy as well. And so what I would challenge you all to do is to think about what, especially early life experiences, were invested in you that set you up to build a strategy now. Because again, my grandmother, so this is what the 80s, 90s in Detroit, again, she grew up Depression era, Appalachia. I mean, this is like, poor is not even beginning to explain it. But it, I mean, I guess to her in a way, it didn't feel abnormal per se, because everybody around her was poor at that time. But her resilience, her money management, right, her ability to navigate systems and build community, because again, she lived in different places. She moved up here and found her way, and her ability to navigate change and challenge. All of those were things that she learned through very hard social times. So not just in her own family, but also in her own family, that she could then use again and again and again and again. And then she was able to pass that down to me. So now when I see obviously what's happening in our community, our country, our world, I'm like, okay, I remember my grandmother telling me stories of how she did this, this, this. And it was almost like automatic. You know, one big thing, I'll just use this as an example. One big thing I started investing in was like, oh, okay, well, I need to start making sure I stock up. Now, part of that came from the pandemic, and I was living in LA at that time, and I wasn't ready. Like, LA shut down almost immediately and just didn't open back up for months and months and months. Like, by the time I was moving to Atlanta, it still kind of was closed. So I wasn't ready. You know, I had like maybe a few rolls of toilet paper, like a little cup, no more of flour. It was crazy. And then it was months before I could get certain things, and I was terrified. So after that, I mean, you know, some of it is like reactionary. Just been like, I never want to run out. But I was able to lean into that and be strategic in how I set up my life, honestly, because I remembered my grandma, like being prepared and knowing how to do things and knowing how to make the most out of stuff and knowing how to, again, navigate systems and navigate difficulty and see the best in people and build connection with folks. Like, that was my view as a child. So at the time when I was a kid, again, I'm picturing I'm always be rich. And when I get up, I'm going to be a corporate attorney. And like, yeah, that's important. But there are moments where no matter how hard I work, there are things happening around me. Right. If the world is in a recession, if the country is in a recession, then yeah, that's going to impact me in some way. And I have to be ready to change my strategy to navigate that. And seeing my grandmother's example is how I've been able to do that. So I just want to bring that to your attention, right? Couple points to remember. First, remember, strategy is a shift in things like reporting lines and hierarchies, and this could be personally and professionally. The hierarchy is not just who reports to who. It's how you structure and stack relationships, connections, ideas, even if it's just in your mind, to get to your goal. That too is a hierarchy, and also recognizing how much of an impact corporate versus individual efforts can have. Those vary constantly, so keeping your eye on that. And then also recognizing that what you've been blessed with, even the difficulties, even the things that seem confusing maybe when it happened, that they are a gift to you to help you figure out how to do what you need to do even now. So how can you mine the past in order to set up your strategy in the present to get to your future? All right. Tell me what you think about that down in the comments. Let me know, you know, how were you raised? How does that impact the way you show up and make decisions now, both personally and professionally? And then, of course, let me know what were some of your favorite influences growing up? Like I said, for me, it's my grandma, and just thinking about how much love she poured into me and so many others in the intentionality. But I would love to hear your stories as well. Let me know down in the comments. And of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. And I will catch y'all in the next one. Bye.